Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
That film tells us more about 1967 than the great successes, you know, the things that came out that were brilliant, the Sgt. Pepper's and things like that. The amount of talent the amount of brilliant people involved in it who had no idea what they were doing, and the waste and the excess and the chaos and the madness, and, you know, the way that Peter Sellers wouldn't be in the same room as Orson Welles.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdell, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Mr. John Hicks, who is the author of many books including William Blake Versus the World, a fantastic look at the romantic poet, and Love and Let Die, the book that we shall be talking about today, which is a cultural history entwining the Beatles and the James Bond film and book series. It's a fascinating, revealing book full of incredible facts that you didn't know and combinations that you might have known but you didn't ever see in this light. So it's a really great read, and if you haven't already read it, I'm sure you'll want to after you hear our conversation. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like and subscribe and do all those things which help the podcast to grow. We've got off to a great 2024. Let's make 2024 the year that Writers on Film really breaks through to a wider audience. If you want, also, if you don't have enough of hearing me talk to people, there's also our sister podcast, Cinema Italia, which is available now, and Connery, the Speculative Fiction, which I have written and Kai Ross narrates, all of which can be found on platforms wherever you go and get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, etc., etc. You can also follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. I'm also around on Instagram and Threads and Blue Sky, lots of different places. So you can find me wherever you do your social media. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. Have to say, I'm a big fan, John, because I really loved your book on William Blake.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. That's always pleasing, that one.
It sent me back to Blake, you know. It sent me to read the long books, which is something I'd never done before.
Excellent.
And yeah, I just found them, because I studied the Romantics when I was at university, and I did my PhD on Shelley. So I was I was very into the Romantics, and Blake was always that outsider character in more ways than one. He was the one guy who's not connected really to anybody else. You know, you can get to Wordsworth via Shelley or Byron or Keats, or, you know, but, and so I kind of neglected him, I think. And when I was reading your book, was a really good, a good excuse to go back to him and reconsider.
It's kind of why the book exists. And there was just that sense that people needed an excuse to go to Blake. Like they, a lot of people thought, well, I like Blake, but I'm not allowed, or like there's something stopping me, or people, I won't understand it, and people will be cross at me, or it, there's this the sense there's gatekeepers around it. There's a sense that there's no obvious way in, you know, beyond the Songs of Innocence and things, and the simpler sort of stuff like that. And so the whole point of the existence of the book is for people to go, oh no, I am allowed. I am allowed in to Blake. I can just sort of go there. So every time I hear you say things like that, I'm like, oh, thank God I wrote that book, because that's another person who's got Blake in their lives. And that's all, that's always a good, you know, that's just more positive world, the more people have Blake in their lives.
Absolutely, because I think the argument that you make is one which is related to this book, which is one, Love and Let Die, which is kind of that there is this British culture and British heritage which is steeped in popular culture.
Yeah.
And it's ever present, but at the same time the continuity and the interweaving isn't as readily apparent as you would think.
Yeah, I mean, if you go, I mean, one thing that really struck me was if you go to Waterstones or a bookshop and you look at the history set shelves, and you know, that's our story. Right? That's how we came to be us. That's our history. But they're all books about power. They're books about maybe military power or royal power, or, you know, economic power or something like that. It's like power is the medium in which we explain ourselves and we tell our story. Power means nothing to most people. We don't have power. It's not our lives. It's a, there's another way of looking at ourselves, and that's imagination, which obviously comes a lot through Blake. And when you see all these books about, you know, wars and, you know, the East India Company and all these great sort of powerful sort of things, you know, a song, you know, a film, these can seem very trivial and very, very small. And it's like the imagination, it's nothing compared to power. But it really is. It's just different. It just acts differently. I see them as like fire and water, you know. Mm. They're completely different. And yet, you know, a forest fire will do as much damage as a tsunami. You know, they act on different scales, but they do shape us and they do form. And so if you have a sense of your history that's just power and not imagination, it doesn't describe how you came to be you, because that's a fundamental part of ourselves, of, you know, how we see the world. It sort of shapes our values, which shapes our actions, which creates history in that sort of way. So, yeah, the story of us, I think, does need to include the imagination. And a lot of that imagination is popular, you know. It's the sort of thing that can be overlooked by cultural elites as trivial or unimportant. And it ain't. It just really isn't.
And it seems, you know, it seems so timely as well, because, you know, I was thinking about this recently, the whole idea of the culture war was a sort of laughable thing. And, you know, but the American right had a very systematic program where they decided, look, the left always win the universities, they always win the culture wars, so to speak, and we're going to stop this. We're going to put ourselves into those decision-making processes. We're going to put ourselves in the BBC. We're going to put and we're going to stop this from happening. And so actually, while we scoffed at from the left, from maybe a position of power, at the idea that the right would ever take over the culture wars. I've just watched Battle of Algiers, and, you know, Mathieu, the colonel, says, why is a Sartre always on their side? You know?
Yes.
And why don't we have any Sartres? And the right seems to have just taken that to heart. And I think the left we've lost our Sartres. We've lost our narrative. We've lost some of that power.
We have, sure, absolutely. But I'm deep in a book about Doctor Who at the moment, so I'm very aware of the way that Russell T. Davis is just sort of shamelessly aiming that franchise at the culture wars to the extent that I don't know. I get the impression he just is at a stage of life where his husband died, and he nursed his husband through their final years. So, and he's been through that, so he's afraid of nothing. Nothing scares him now. So the inclusion of trans characters in particular, or you know, casting a Rwandan immigrant as the Doctor, all these things that he's doing them shamelessly, and on the understanding that the right will flare up in anger, but also look ridiculous at the same time. You know, the recent specials, Yasmin Finney was in it as a character called Rose Temple. And, you know, the BBC got about 114 complaints that there was a trans woman cast on television and shown in a loving, supporting family, right? And he knows full well that seeing a trans woman in a loving, supporting family is new. You don't get that on TV. It changes things when you see that. It makes things, people get it in a way. And those 114 complaints, just nothing. That's just nothing compared to the millions of people seeing that sort of thing. So, yeah, it is a bit of a battleground at times, isn't it? James Bond is definitely an interesting character to talk about in that and that sort of field.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing that sort of staggered me in the book, and this book is full. I mean, I know I've been watched Bond. I've read all the Bond novels twice. I read them as a kid, and then I sort of had a nostalgic, I want to read them again, and read them as an adult.
Do you have a favourite, John?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think the ones which are sort of closer to the films I loved when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I think On Her Majesty's Secret Service stands out as a genuinely good novel and a genuinely good film. I think those Goldfinger and On Her Majesty's Secret Service would be the ones, but they kind of bleed into each other much more readily than some of the others. I remember reading Moonraker and thinking, where are the spaceships? What do you mean they don't leave the Earth? You know,
they just stay in Kent.
Yeah, and there's a really long car chase. And if there's anything that you can't do in a novel, it's kind of a car chase.
Yeah,
it's
like... absolutely. I think it was on Watling Street as well, on the E2. I think that's one of my favourites, though, weirdly. I believe I'm wrong in this, and that Fishing Yardage will tell me I'm wrong to really like the novel of Moonraker. But there's something... I don't know. It was before the globe-trotting became a key sort of part of it. It was a very early sort of novel. And it's just a really fun, exciting, you know, read. It sort of said a lot about Britain in in the late 1950s.
I've just received a copy. I'm slowly collecting the ones with the big James Bond, which I think is the late 60s. On the cover, because those were the ones I read as a kid. I remember going to a secondhand bookshop when I was a kid and just buying them all for like 20p each, and then obviously losing them and now wanting to get them back. And I've just received Moonraker today through the post, so that's going to be poured over at some point. But the fact that sort of begins your book, and it's one of the many facts is that Sean Connery's Dr. No comes out the same week as the first Beatles.
Same day. Same afternoon.
I mean, how the hell?
Friday afternoon in October. And suddenly Beatles records and James Bond films exist in a way they didn't like the Thursday before, the day before.
Well, that's worthy of the Virginia Woolf sort of idea of, you know, sometime on Thursday afternoon in 1917, modernism was born. You know,
yes, it's
it's exactly that. sea change.
It is. I mean, and it's, I mean, politically, you're looking at that period after the Suez Crisis, when even, you know, the most pro-establishment reactionary figure had to admit that Britain was no longer a global power in the way that we had been for centuries. For centuries, we'd understood ourselves in terms of, you know, Britannia rules the waves, you know, the sun never sets on the British Empire. That's who we were. And then we weren't that. And that raises the question of, well, if we're not that, then, like, who are we? You know, we need, Britain sort of needed an answer to that. Who are we? So I can understand the way that the Beatles and the James Bond films, which in very different ways answered that question in very different answers, being so successful over here, really sort of hitting a nerve. What's interesting is that the rest of the world went crazy for them as well. So it can't just be that, you know, there must be something more there. And I just am endlessly fascinated by the way that neither of those phenomena make any sense in comparison, like, to their peers. You know, the idea that you could make an action movie starring one action hero and then go on and make, you know, 26 sequels over, you know, 60 years, and everyone will be successful and everyone will make money. It's ludicrous. Mm. Like, every film producer would be doing that if it was any way possible to do that. It's not possible. It can't. But the fact that James Bond exists, you'd be laughing at me for even suggesting it. You know, and yet it does. It just, the normal rules don't apply to those films. And the same with the Beatles, you know, the idea that four lads could sort of come together and produce a body of work of that, well, quality, but also influence and sort of change the way we Britain or British people sort of viewed themselves, leaving the world a different place afterwards than it was before. You know, the idea that a band can expect to be bigger than the Beatles, right? It's a joke. You know, it's never going to happen, you know. So they're both weird, weird anomalies. And the fact that they both appeared on the same afternoon, I can't help but see them as twins, you know, these sort of competing, you know, it's, obviously it's love and death. You know, it's Eros and Thanatos. It's Mars and Venus. It's these sort of opposing parts in our psyche sort of fighting with each other as we try to sort of work out the modern version of ourselves. You know, I just couldn't resist. Once I realized that date tied them both together, you know, I just thought, oh, this is a fascinating one. And, you know, I've always wanted to write about the Beatles, but you just, there's a lot of books about them. There's over 2,000 books about the Beatles. And to find a way that you can just put them in a perspective, a slight shift of perspective where you start seeing new things about them, when you start to understand them on a deeper level, it's just a joy to be able to write something like that.
And I mean, the sense I had as I went through the book is, and the book is so brilliantly structured because you sort of, it's almost like a series of these mini essays, and you are going forward, but there's also a sense that each essay is like a capsule in itself. And I kept expecting you to sort of, there's a point where you're going to run out of connections, but they just continue to proliferate. They just continue to go on as you go through. I mean, right up until the present day, you know, it's just constant.
Yeah, it's because their cultural footprints were so big, they're going to overlap and they're going to sort of continually overlap. But when you get things like, I mean, I talk about the importance of the Bond girl Strawberry Fields as the moment where the rule that, you know, if James Bond sleeps with a woman, they die. This very, very toxic sort of problematic part of the character. That sort of changes with Strawberry Fields. And it would be a Beatles-themed Bond girl in this particular book. It was just too perfect. It was just, and I loved the way that everyone talked about it in this book. It's Ringo who ends up married to the Bond girl.
Yes,
it's just lovely, isn't it? Everyone knows that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And Christopher Lee is on the cover of the Wings album
at the time that he's Scaramanga. Yeah, and that's just gave me just. John, it was an excuse. I basically just wanted to write about Christopher Lee, and I have done for some time. And I thought, that's enough of an excuse to just do a few thousand words on Christopher Lee, and nobody's complained. I've just randomly chucked in a Christopher Lee chapter based on that slightly flimsy reasoning. But, you know, when you have a life as exciting as that, no one's going to mind a chapter like that sneaking in a book.
But, I mean, it's a James Bond concept as well, that there's this web that's going across the world of relationships that are hidden and you're bringing them to light. So So in that sense, that the format of your book is perfectly in accordance with the Bond universe. You know, little lights are sort of...
Yeah. You can see a map on a big screen as MI5 or something like that.
Exactly.
Connecting them all up.
Yeah, and there was so many, I love the biographical portraits that you give of Sean Connery, you give of Ian Fleming, you give of all these characters who really are characters. I mean, the fact that Sean Connery punches out Johnny Stompinato.
Yes. Just given his name, you know that that's brave.
Yeah. Well, I know him from the James Ellroy novels and the, you know, he regularly turns up killing people and, you know, being brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all those lives were fascinating. And the thing that, again, one of those coincidences that seems to be a bit too much of a coincidence is the way that every single person in the book, with the exception of the two Georges, George Harrison and George Martin, did not come from a stable nuclear family where they were raised by their two biological parents. Mm. And obviously we know about John Lennon and Paul McCartney using their mothers and things like that, but it goes much, much further than that. It's like, you know, it's like Alan Klein being raised in an orphanage. It's like Yoko not seeing her father till she was three. It's like Linda McCartney's parents dying in a plane crash when she was a teenager. And a lot of it was due to the war, you know, Pete Best and his family. And there was a lot of death as normal in the lives of all these sort of people. And it was one of those coincidences that started to feel a bit odd the more I noticed it, and I started looking in and seeing everybody's backstories. There did seem to be these phenomenally talented and creative and troubled people coming out of the sort of fire of this global world war, did seem to be significant in shaping people, you know, generations later.
I had a friend called Patty who she comes from a generation probably two generations older than me, and she said that people from who lived through the war, they just didn't. It goes back to what you were saying about Russell T. Davis. They were brave because not brave because they were physically courageous, but because they'd sort of seen it. So they were like, they knew what was little. They knew the stuff they didn't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And yet the Beatles are sort of, there's that great quote that you take from Hard Day's Night of, you know, I fought in the war for the likes of you. I bet you wish you'd lost.
Yes.
You know, which was
God, it's so funny, that film. I love that film. But the fact that it came out at the same time as Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And the weird little crossovers between them, like Shirley Easton is painted gold on the poster of Goldfinger, and she's plays the masseuse, and then there she is and the gambling club that Wilfred Bramble, playing Paul's pretend Irish granddad, sort of goes into, and that's the same club that you first meet James Bond in Dr. No, the Le Cirque gambling room and the Ambassadeurs or something like that. The way that they cross over like this is really fascinating. The guy who fought in the war for you lot is the guy who's briefing James Bond about gold smuggling, you know, and the way that character's treated. And it's, in my head, it's the same character.
Yeah.
You know, he looks the same. He's dressed the same. But
he's probably on his way to that meeting.
Yeah, he probably is, where he will be respected. You know, he'll be treated with deference, whereas on the train with the oiks, you know, he's a figure of fun. And it's that notion of the bowler hat, you know, a bowler-hatted figure. The country's asking, should that figure be respected like automatically, or are they ridiculous? And in Goldfinger, the bowler hat's a weapon. You know, odd job's got, you'll take your head off with this by throwing this bowler hat at you. It's a, the bowler hat is a thing to be feared. But at the same time, out comes A Hard Day's Night, and a bowler hat's just hilarious, you know, the pompousness of it and stuff like that. So you can sort of see the culture wars then sort of playing out in these sort of things. And culture wars are always ridiculous looking in hindsight, because they're not really about what they're about. You know, there's so much about hair length on men in that story. And it was such a issue that George Lazenby wasn't allowed to attend the premiere of his Bond film because he'd grown his hair sort of shoulder length, sort of. He looked a bit like George Best. You know, he looked great. But at the time, because of the culture war and because of the way Cubby Broccoli, you know, was of the older generation, stuff like that, he wouldn't have James Bond being associated with these long hairs. So he was banned from sort of coming from it. And, you know, decades later, it looks stupid, but it's kind of more about roles of masculinity and deeper questions like that, which were changing and which do sort of hint at significant shifts occurring within our culture.
I mean, you managed to bring out that real sense of how, at the time, how different the Beatles are, in the sense that we're looking back, you bring up a really good point of Peter Jackson's documentary, that watching it now, you see the Beatles as, oh, they're just ordinary, they're just like you and me. And it's only when you go outside and see the people waiting, you know, what's going on up there on the roof, that suddenly yeah. you get all these people who look like they're from the 1950s and 40s.
Absolutely.
And it's you think, my God, it does look like the Beatles have come from outer space.
Absolutely. In the world of, you know, headscarves and, again, bowler hats and those clipped accents and the people you meet outside, it feels like the Beatles are modern humans who had got trapped in the past and was having to change culture enough for us to catch up with them. You know, that is what it feels like. Yeah, the Beatles just get bigger the further we get away from them. You know, it wasn't that long ago that people would talk about the Beatles and the Stones as if they were, you know, in some way comparable or unequal sort of.
Oh, there was a House of Love song, the Beatles and the Stones.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You don't hear that now. No disrespect to the Stones, but when people talk about Beatles, it's usually the Beatles and Shakespeare. And those are the things that sort of define, you know, English and British culture. It's the relationships between those four men that are just so fascinating, that even if the music hadn't been as varied and as brilliant as it was, they would still be fascinating. But put everything together, put the quality of the brilliance of their music together with those four relationships. And it does seem to have been a shift in the way that it's looked at now. You know, in the sort of 80s and the 90s, music journalists, they sort of wrote about them in terms of competition. It was like, well, who's best? It's John Lennon's best. Paul McCartney's not as good as John Lennon. That was the general thing. But we're starting to see female writers write about the Beatles at last. Slowly, there's still a huge void there. But there's been a shift into looking at them, essentially a love story, essentially as the relationships between them. And that's just opened up so much more and given us so much more insight than this very sort of simple sort of competition-based analysis of them. So, yeah, even though decades and decades have gone, we're still seeing them fresh and seeing them new and finding new ways to sort of think about them. And it is kind of puts them in the world of myth, which is constantly rewarding, and in that every culture looks at it, changes it, comes up with something completely different, and still finds it of value. You know, it is fascinating to see how the Beatles are seen change as we get further and further away from them.
And as we come through their making films, I mean, one question I had when I was, well, actually, I'll leave that to a little bit later, but you describe Help as basically a spoof Bond film,
yes.
with the and then And then Casino Royale is like a spoof Bond film via the Beatles, you know, talking about the David Niven.
Yeah, casino. The 1967 Casino Royale.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just, I mean, there must be somewhere shelves and shelves of the footage that they shot so much stuff that what the mess that the final film became is just a fraction of all this stuff.
We want Peter Jackson to put it back together, yes, don't you? You know, yeah,
but it's. I think that film tells us more about 1967 than the great successes. You know, the things that came out that worked, that were brilliant, the Sergeant Peppers and things like that. That the amount of talent just the amount of brilliant people involved in it who had no idea what they were doing, and the waste and the excess and the chaos and the madness, and you know, the way that Peter Sellers wouldn't be in the same room as Orson Welles. And
the Roger Lewis book that you quote is one of the best books I've ever read about a filmmaker. The life and death of Peter Sellers is just a work of genius.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do think Peter Sellers is the sort of figure that we need to look at again, because it's that genius to madness trajectory. It was very, very quick.
Yeah, it took like 5 minutes.
Yeah, it did. and I think there's a Dr. Strangelove play with, Amanda Iannucci is doing Dr. Strangelove and things like that. So maybe he'll be in the air a little bit more. But yeah, I think Peter Sellers is one of those endlessly, endlessly fascinating characters.
And what the question I wanted to ask, in a way, was I don't know why this had never occurred to me before, but all the filmmaking that they do, the Beatles, they seem to tend to keep it around a sort of British-based film industry. And I always wondered why there was never a sense that the Beatles went to Hollywood.
No, that's true.
They didn't do like the Elvis thing of let's just go and see if we can find a vehicle, or what can Hollywood do for us? And I just wonder if that was because they were, you know, they couldn't separate off and like go and do single things. They had to do it all together.
Yeah. I mean, it started off because, you know, Brian Epstein just didn't have contacts over there, but he was in London and so could get the first film going and the third. But by the time they were doing Magical Mystery Tour, I don't think they'd have been interested in going to Hollywood in the slightest. You know, they were just trying to sort of do it themselves and do a sort of weird, arty, psychedelic experiment. You know, it just so happened that because they were the Beatles, it became the big Boxing Day BBC broadcast in black and white, where it scared the bejesus out of the population watching it. Yeah, I can't imagine what a big sort of Hollywood Beatles film would be. I mean, there was
a Rat Pack sort of.
When they attempted to remake Yellow Submarine, was it maybe 15 years ago in CG? And they abandoned it, but they leaked, a few images were leaked, and they were just horrifying. You know, it was just awful. It was just terrible, terrible sort of stuff. I'm sure at some point there will be a Yellow Submarine series or remake or you know, something on Disney Plus or
the Beatles universe.
The Beatles universe. Because essentially, you know, you see things like, you know, the ABBA tour, the virtual sort of people and the... And you think, oh, I wonder what the Beatles would do in with this sort of technology. And they are very good at Apple. This is, they are very good at not doing anything but just the right thing, you know, not going out there. But basically, we all want to go to Pepperland. And that's not going to go away. And at some point, there will be some virtual live sort of thing. I hope, anyway. I hope so. With all the latest, you know, hologram and AI technology and all that sort of stuff. If you hear that, that's my cat attempting to destroy the room.
That's okay.
that's just normal. Just sort of ignore that.
What's your cat's name?
His name is Dennis.
That's not Bond or Beatles based. Yeah,
it was my daughter when she was 10. Was very keen on the Beano. Cat. She gets to name it.
Fair enough.
Is therefore called Dennis. It's not on me.
Right, fair enough. Dennis O'Brien is the only link I could.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we come to the end of the Beatles, and we come to sort of a change in a turbulent period as well for the Bond franchise, roughly the same period. And in a way, the end of the Beatles isn't the end of the Beatles, because obviously the continuity goes on today. You know, Get Back being a prime example of a resurgence in interest.
A new single was number one this past 12 months.
Exactly. The Rolling Stones must be so pissed off. They did a whole album. They did a live tour, and the Beatles still pip them. They still can't shake it. Half dead, they're still winning.
There's that great story of Paul McCartney going on to a Rolling Stones album launch where they were playing the new album, and all the great and good of swing in London was there. And it's great. Yeah. He just goes to the, I've just brought this acetate. This, like, it was the, it just recorded Hey Jude.
Yeah.
And they just play this latest thing. And they.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Put the thing on, the room just felt silent, and everyone was just sort of listening to it. And then they weren't, you know, they weren't expecting the song to sort of then go on to a 7-minute sort of single. And I'd never heard before. It was like something they never heard before. And it's just like, oh, Paul, it was their launch party, for God's sake.
wacky Macca, and he's coupons.
Just a sort of, just one little piece of 7-inch vinyl, just to sort of
ruin everything.
Ruin everything for them. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, so we're getting into this transition, and people like George Lazenby are sort of going, "Oh, okay, the it's changing. Bond is out of favor. It's not going to last." And you get And obviously, with the Beatles breaking up, that feels like there's an end of an era. Mm. But even with the afterlives of the Beatles, and I'm always surprised at how young the Beatles are when they break up.
I know.
Because that's a long time to be an ex-Beatle.
Yeah, very true. Very, you know, in that George Lazenby film you mentioned, you know, that was the start of the still ongoing tradition, in which every time a Bond film comes out, a journalist will write an article saying, yeah, you should stop it with these Bond films now, lads. They're a little bit, you know, it's gone, you know, it's out of date. And it happened in the late 60s, and they happened throughout the 70s, and those articles, they happened throughout the 80s and the 90s and the noughts, and up to the latest No Time to Die. There's always the, it's time to stop this now, article sort of coming. And it would have made sense in 67. You know, it was, you know, an establishment assassin did not fit into the make love, not war culture. And the reason George Lazenby didn't sign on for any more, despite being offered an awful lot of money, was because he thought it was dead, it was over, you know. And the notion to him that it wouldn't die, and that the Beatles would be over in like a year or so, would have just floored him, I think. It seemed to be completely the opposite. But the way that, well, as I say this, I'm conscious that when I wrote the book, the idea that now in 2024, there wouldn't have been another Bond film. The new Bond wouldn't have been cast. It wouldn't have been on the next phase and stuff like that. I wouldn't have believed it at all. You know, they finished the last one in 2019, 5 years ago. And they just seem stuck. They just seem not to know what to do, how to reintroduce this character to a 2020s audience, because they've got to get a young audience back on, you know, otherwise it will just be an aging and dwindling, you know, audience sort of following this. And in, say, in the mid-90s, when Pierce Brosnan came out, they were able to huck it to the zeitgeist, that Britpoppy, celebratory, you know, have a good time, don't think of the consequences, laddie sort of retro vibe very easily. And things like the Nintendo 64 GoldenEye game, it all fitted together, you know, great. And it really reinvigorated and it kept it going for, you know, another Generation X, which is what I am. You know, we just got totally on board at that point and we've been watching them ever since. But Generation Z, for the young people, you know, Bond is essentially everything they're against. You know, he's the enemy. You know, quite how they're going to reinvent it for now will be fascinating. Will be fascinating to see. And the longer they sort of go without, I mean, to hear them talking, they haven't really started yet. They haven't really got it. It's like they just don't seem to be able to see how to do it. And I'm, you know, I'm starting to reassess in the book. I just think, look, just look at the history. The thing goes on. It goes on.
Yeah,
ignores all these sort of things. It goes on. It does speak to something inside us. It does speak to, you know, our need for a hero. There is something about an idealized sort of masculine presence that changes throughout culture. But as long as it hits that, it will sort of go on. But yeah, where is it though? Where is it, John? I can't see it.
It's that that real trick of having to change and in changing even a revolutionary way, but at the same time maintain a certain consistency and not.
Yeah.
That I can imagine is nerve-wracking to. And the other thing they have to look out for is in 2030 in America and 2035 in Britain, the copyright's up. So if they don't have anything sort of well-established in the next few years, there's nothing stopping any other studio just stepping in and going, we're going to release our own Bond series.
And it's got, you know, everything, you know, Moneypenny, Felix Leiter, you know, all the extra characters, the, you know, M, they're all part of the copyright. It all becomes clear. The only thing that Eon have got is that gun barrel opening and the music.
Right.
Both of which are established within the first minute of the very first film on 5th of October, 1962. And both of which together, I think, may be enough to make you think it's not really Bond if it doesn't have that music and it doesn't have that sort of thing. I mean, you know full well that the moment, the day the copyright ends, there's going to be a novel which is a reimagining of Casino Royale told from Vesper Lynn's perspective, like on bookshelves. You know, it'll be written and waiting. You know it.
That's the literary fiction version.
Absolutely. And there'll be a lot... People will be doing a lot of things with it. So they kind of, you know... do need to reestablish the films for this audience, but they're not going to have the budgets that they've had, the way that the box office has been. They aren't going to be getting away with spending $300 million on a film or anything like that, which may be part of the problem. I don't know.
I mean, it would be interesting to see. I mean, they always have this thing of occasionally... you know, getting very excessive and then pulling back and stripping down and doing it for your eyes only after Moonraker. And, you know, there's always, you know, whenever you watch the additional contents on the DVDs, they're always saying, yes, for this one, we wanted to go back to the books. We wanted to go back to the character. And it's like, really? For your eyes only, he has a parrot that talks to Margaret Thatcher. I don't remember that being in a short story. you know, are you sure you're going back to the character? I mean, yeah, he kicks a guy off a cliff, but that's about it, you know.
When they say that, they mean, we just took a surname from like a character in a short story and we gave it to a completely different person. All this going back to character. They're a long way from the character now.
Yeah.
From the character in the books. I mean, Roger Moore was a long way from the character in the books. You know?
Well, even Sean Connery. I love that bit that I never knew this, that you know, Ian Fleming writes in a Scottish, the idea that he went to a Scottish school, FETS, as because Sean Connery had been cast. So it was like, okay, I'll do that retroactively. I'll put in this.
In the final book, Sean Connery was not how Ian Fleming viewed James Bond at all. You know, he was quite against it. It's just when he saw how successful it was being, he wasn't daft. You know, he sort of. What gets me is this notion that he went to FETS and that Sean Connery did know FETS because he used to deliver milk there.
Was the milk boy, yeah. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. And I think it's so wonderful to have in this age of PR. I interview a lot of people and it's always through a PR, often with a PR in the room.
Mm.
And you have these people like Connery who are just so unfiltered. So that's like, what do you think of Ian Fleming? Oh, he was a terrible snob. You know, what do you think? What do you think of Cubby Broccoli? Oh, I hate that man. He's just like, he was so, you know, he did his publicity tours, basically denigrating the thing that he was supposed to be publicizing. Yeah. You know, it was kind of refreshing, that level of honesty.
You get Christopher Eccleston has it a little bit.
Mm.
But there was this great interview where he was talking about our friends in the North. And he was like, oh, Gina McKee, she was superb. And, you know, Daniel Craig, it's been brilliant watching his. I could tell the talent that he had and all this sort of stuff. And was it Mark Strong? He goes, didn't like him. But his performance was good.
He said a similar thing about, I think it was Danny Boyle when he did Shallow Grave. He said Danny Boyle got us to live in a flat for like a month while we were rehearsing and preparing the film. And he said, that was just bullshit. I'm an actor. I don't need to live in a flat. I don't need to, I've lived with people I don't like. I don't need to do this. It's not a strange experience. It's not exotic as an experience.
Yeah.
Where do you think Bond is going to go? What's your prediction?
Well, I think it needs to be fun again. I think, you know, he is this sort of idealized fantasy of what it is to be male. And I think at some point we're going to have to allow a sense of fun into that again, you know, rather than the angst-ridden sort of side that we've seen recently. I also wonder whether the thing to question, It's not so much his attitude to women and stuff, which they've addressed quite well and has changed to the extent that when the last film came out, the word woke wasn't enough for the Daily Mail to describe No Time to Die. And they coined the word super woke for it. You know,
right,
it's like,
right.
It's like
right.
When a James Bond film is like, not, you know, we're definitely a long way from Fleming at that sort of point. But the issue is the idea that the British Crown has the right to go around the world and kill anyone that they like. That I don't think people are looking at. You know, when say Putin sends assassins to Britain in the Salisbury poisonings and things like that, we're outraged. You know, the notion that a state can have an assassin department where they have a license to kill, they have the right to kill anyone. And I don't think that holds. I think that needs looking at because that's dodgy. That's... And the rest of the, you can imagine how the rest of the security services would see this 007 division. They would be dark, you know, it wouldn't be talked about. It would be, you know, you wouldn't go for a drink with those guys, you know, that'd be some. I do wonder if they will, you know, examine that aspect of the character.
Was that why Jason Bourne ultimately didn't have legs? Was because his superhero, super spy department was essentially black ops, and he had to rebel against it. So you know, there's only so long he can rebel against it before he's done it, and there's no bureaucracy to send him on a new mission every film. You know, it becomes just, when does he bring it down and what happens afterwards? With Bond, he never attempt. I mean, you know, there's been a couple of films where he's semi-retired or given up the license to kill or whatever.
Goes rogue.
Yeah, but he always comes back to the fold, and it's always very avuncular. You know, you have this idea of Q being this sort of avuncular guy. He's got blood on his hands, that man. He's always giving things to Bond that, you know, in the final act will blow up, you know, a black person, or
he's an arms dealer. He creates weapons, and we just think of him as this lovely guy, you know. You know, it's very noticeable that nobody, you know, fantasizes about being Jason Bourne. You know, there is something different about, and the fact that Fleming had been in naval intelligence and they'd sort of come out the war. All those things I was talking about there made total sense at that point. Of course you would have, you know, an assassin department, and of course they would have, you know, pens that fire poison tip darts and things like that, because in the war these have been necessary. This is part of natural stagecraft. You need these people, you know. There's only every time someone goes rogue in a film, my sort of heart drops these days, because I've just seen that story so often. But it is a reaction that, well, they're supposed to be the hero. They work for the bad people doing bad things, so therefore they have to rebel against that. And it is a story we're a bit sick of, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Mission Impossible has been running that story for the last few films, and it just, like, I've lost track. Which organization are you working for? Why are you doing this? What is at stake?
I can't remember the last time he didn't go rogue.
In
the Mission Impossible films.
Yeah.
It's like
Spock having an emotion. It's sort of like he's the most emotional guy on the Enterprise. He's always. You cold-hearted Vulcan, you're crying again.
Yeah. Deep down in the heart of the James Bond character, there is this sense of it's wish fulfillment, because he can do whatever he likes.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the core of it. That's the sort of, imagine if the rules didn't really apply to you, but you were still a good guy. You were still a good guy, and you were working towards the greater good. I think will have an eternal appeal. But shaping it for now is going to be fascinating how to go about it. There was talk of there's a lot of rumours. Suddenly this Christopher Nolan, or, you know, whichever director is linked to it, and they're not, or this character, and they're not. Many an agent has slipped out a rumour to a friend in the press to raise the profile of their client, and you can't really take them. You know, we know what that game is. But there was talk of the next film having bonded two stages of his lives with two actors, a young one and an older one, which I thought was interesting. So that suggests that they are sort of trying to come up with something a little different, a little bit different, that we haven't quite seen before. And I, you know, I have no idea whether that would work, or the extent that it focuses too much on the character, because actors want to focus on the character. You know, Daniel Craig wanted his heroic deaths and all these sort of things. But Bond is a little bit like a video game's avatar, and that they're distinctive enough so you recognize them immediately, but they're slightly bland enough that you identify with them. Really, you're being Bond in these things, really. It's you can project yourself onto them, because their motivations are quite simple and clear, and they're your motivations as well. You don't want that guy to destroy the world, so you know that the right thing to do is to climb out of that window and sort of leap onto that crane and all those sort of things. There's a slight video games aspect to the character, which is not the sort of thing that actors are pushing for, probably not the sort of thing that directors are pushing for, but it is vital to the appeal of those things. So yeah, we will see. We should know by now. I mean, God's sake, 2024.
Yeah, I mean, it does strike me that there's a sort of element that they pick a journeyman for the director, and that's why Danny Boyle didn't work, and why Christopher Nolan, I think, wouldn't necessarily be, you know, and someone like Sam Mendes is kind of perfect because I don't think he's really that good a director, and he's, you know, he can do that's, you know, a perfect thing for him to do. I think the same thing is sort of true of the actor, that it's got to be someone who's kind of previously unknown, so that you're always going, oh, right, I've seen him on television, but I don't know if he's, you know, that sort of. The one thing that is different to Jason Bourne and to the Mission Impossible is I think the baddie. I think the baddie is the thing that really defines. The baddie has all the personality, and is like the super ego of the film. I mean, you would be really hard put to name who is the baddie in a Jason Bourne film. You know, is it Brian Cox or is it the guy, Chris Cooper? You know, it's one of those guys, but it could easily be anybody else, you know?
Yeah.
It could be Tom Wilkinson. It could be anyone.
Yeah.
But with even a bad baddie like No Time to Die, you know, you remember it's the guy who won the Oscar for Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes, absolutely.
You know who's in that position.
It comes up to mind immediately when you think of the film. So, yeah. You know, you think of Casino Royale, you go, that was Miles Mikkelsen, you know, you think of Tomorrow Never Dies, it was Jonathan Pryce, you know, they're probably the most prominent part of the film in your memory.
Yeah.
You know, the man with the golden gun, that's Christopher Lee, that's Scaramanga. And so it was a real shame that the way they messed up the Blofeld in the, well, in my opinion.
Oh, the Chris Waltz.
Fantastic actor. The whole making him the half-brother thing, I'm still appalled by, because...
Yeah, they obviously, it was a Harry Potterization of James Bond, that it was sort of, let's make it a big family sort of soap opera, really. Yeah,
absolutely. And also because you're giving the Bond character a bunch of motivation that the audience doesn't really share.
Mm-hmm.
That thing I was talking about, them being like a video game avatar, you're on their side because it's very clear what they do. You're not hurt by the fact that your father was the skiing, you were raised by the skiing instructor whose son was all this complicated stuff. But then to establish Blofeld and then immediately just waste him in the next film and kill him off was a really strange, you know, you've got Blofeld. That's a good villain. You can use him as a villain, not just a guy in a cage who just then dies, you know.
Yes,
it's just a very odd choice.
There were so many odd choices. I remember Skyfall, the one that I thought was very, very funny was they got Albert Finney to replace it was supposed to be played by Sean Connery, the sort of gameskeeper. Yes. And there's this reveal, and the reveal, instead of being like, it's Sean Connery, it was like, who is that? Yeah. Is it David Hemmings or Albert Finney?
It would have been too weird, though, if Sean Connery had stepped into that film.
Yeah, but it sort of speaks to the mutability of the whole thing. The fact that people forget that Judi Dench was M for Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
And then M again in Casino Royale when James Bond hasn't got his license to kill yet.
Yeah. In my head, this is my canon, all the Brosnan films take place after Quantum of Solace. Right. So it starts with Casino Royale. And
okay.
There's Judi Dench's M. He gets the car. He gets the Alfa Romeo.
Aston Martin.
I was blanking on that car name. Aston Martin. I'm at that age where suddenly things go. So he gets all that. And Quantum of Solace happened. You don't need Quantum of Solace, but there it is. And then afterwards, he's become James Bond. And so you meet him in GoldenEye and he's driving, you know, the Aston Martin around Monte Carlo and he's gambling and he's being James Bond and he's loving being James Bond and all that sort of stuff. So it goes through his films till you get to the start of Die Another Day when he's captured and he's, tortured for years in North Korea, and he sort of, you know, escapes in it. And that explains why when you get to Skyfall, he's old and broken and beaten. And the shifting of all the cues from Robert Llewellyn to John Cleese to Ben Whishaw makes total sense if you look at it in these sort of, and it flows much better and it makes a lot more sense. The only problem is you have to believe that in the James Bond universe, the name Moneypenny is a bit more common than it is here, because there's a few people called Moneypenny, or two people with the same name doing the same job. But if you can buy that, the whole arc makes much more sense. And it was odd that they went from, they establish, you know, Daniel Craig, he becomes James Bond, and he becomes James Bond at the end of that film. And then when, you know, Skyfall happens, it's all him being old and no good. It's like they missed out the sort of, you know, the glory years, the fun glory years.
The 14 missions that he went on.
Yeah. Absolutely, which is what you want. You know, you don't introduce Blofeld just to kill him off. You don't sort of establish James Bond just to have him as a dying old wreck. But yeah, so if you view them in that order, they make total sense. That's my canon anyway. It's my head canon.
And I love the way that you're a little bit disturbed by a couple of people sharing the name Moneypenny, but not the fact that Pierce Brosnan, Daniel Craig, turns into Pierce Brosnan and then back into Daniel Craig. That bit's fine.
That's what happens in films and TV. You know, suddenly people have different faces. That's just, I can accept that.
That's easy.
I think with the Bond thing, the easiest way of dealing with all this is just that whatever you're watching at any particular time, that's correct. Everything else you've just remembered slightly wrong, but it all happened, but you've just remembered it slightly. So don't worry about it. Inconsistencies like that.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know, he has that, you know, famous line, this never happened to the other guy.
That's right, the other fella, yeah.
And then he goes to his office and pulls out a bunch of references to other films and sort of does this huge nostalgic sort of... And
absolutely.
It's just like,
for the first time as well. Yeah, there's nothing like that. And then the opening titles were like clips from the previous films and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's odd.
It really is sort of like, forget this is the new guy, but also remember everything we've done and everything you've enjoyed. And this is going to be continuity as well.
Yeah.
You know.
And then you get Roger Moore standing at the grave of his wife. His wife.
And another Blofeld gets killed in a similarly sort of dismissive way as well, dropped down a chimney as a.
And that was the serious reboots. You know, we're going back to, you know, Fleming sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This will be much more serious, not so fanciful. We'll just start by dropping Blofeld in a wheelchair down a chimney from a helicopter.
Brilliant. Well done. Well done. You've got topples in there, so it's all going to be good. It's all going to come out in the wash.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very easy to criticize things like the Bond films, and there's lots of good reasons to do so. But I think what's more interesting is the fact that despite all those things, there is something there that means that the films keep coming back and are always successful, and we always watch them, and we always go back to sort of James Bond. That's much harder to sort of pin down than this little sniping about, as I've been doing. Sorry.
No, absolutely. I feel exactly the same. I must have bought the DVDs at least three times, and I've, you know, I've already said about buying the books a number of times. I've read them a few times. I've watched the films countless times.
Mm.
And I kind of know they're not 90% of it. They're not good novels and they're not good films. Yeah, 90% of them. There's the occasional exception. But for some reason, they are bigger than the whole.
They're more important to you than some good films and some good novels, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They matter more. And that's what I think is interesting.
Yeah,
I'm sort of dealing with that. As I say, I'm writing about Doctor Who at the same time, which, you know, has exactly the same thing. You know, it could be very easy to sort of criticize, but the reason why it's still with us is much more important and much more relevant.
So your Doctor Who is Tom Baker, I'm guessing?
Yeah.
Tom Baker, same here. Yeah.
Absolutely. I worked with Tom Baker about 15 years ago. I used to make preschool programs for Channel 5, and we had him as a narrator. And so I it's a story I tell in the book. It was one glorious day. I got to go to the pub with Tom Baker after a sound session. And he went to it was a pub called the Yorkshire Grey in Soho. And it's a Sam Smith's pub. You know,
how many weeks were you in there?
he's not the drinker that he was,
right? You know? Right.
In the 70s, yeah, he just put a pillow down there, and he'd be good. But we're at the bar, and we're talking about which drinks to get, because it's not the normal drinks you get in Sam Smith's pub. And so we're having that little conversation, and I just looked up, and around the corner of the bar there was a guy who looked about my age, and he was there at the bar with his pint of, I think it was a lager, and I just happened to look at him the moment that he looked up and saw Tom Baker sort of at the bar, and I'll never forget the expression on his face, because it wasn't like, oh, like a little smile. Oh, there's that guy off the telly, or there's a 1970s children's television actor, or anything like that. It was awe. It was genuinely awe. It was like he just stepped through the wardrobe and entered Narnia. Mm. You know, he was in his normal, everyday, most mundane, stand at the bar world, and then suddenly, he's not. Suddenly the sight of this one actor transported him, you know. And I think about that expression an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quality to these things that film criticism or literary criticism or criticism in general sort of misses.
Mm.
You know, the things that matter, that shape us, really, that are part of our lives, and a beautiful, wonderful part of our lives, that can't quite be described intellectually. They can be rationalized, but it's not rational, you know. That's important. That's what I think I'm trying to get trying to sort of celebrate, I think.
Yeah. It sort of becomes part of our psychogeography. Our psychic landscape is populated by these people.
Yeah.
And these experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
That's wonderful, John. I've so much enjoyed the conversation, but I have to ask you one last question, which is, I always ask for a recommendation of a film book. A book that has in some way either you've just enjoyed, or it's influenced you, or you wish to recommend to our listeners to get them reading.
I mean, the one that immediately jumped to mind when you said a film book was David Lynch's Room to Dream.
Mm.
And it's not just David Lynch. I'm trying to think of the name of, I can see it here. It's Christine McKenna. I can see half the name. My name's Christine. He's co-written it with another writer. And the way it works is it's basically a biography, but it's half autobiography and half biography written by this other writer. So you get David Lynch's recollections of the period, and then a proper researcher going away and writing exactly what happened. And it's the best of both worlds. It's superbly done. It really is. And when you have such a fascinating and inscrutable sort of filmmaker like David Lynch, it's the best way to tell us. You need their perspective, because no one else sees the world in the way that David Lynch does. Mm. But to marry that with, context and accuracy and all the great sort of things. Brilliant book. Room to Dream. Love it. Yeah.
Christine McKenna is the co-author.
Yes.
Thank
you.
I would further recommend anybody who hasn't read it to maybe even try the audio version, the Audible. It's on Audible, I think.
I haven't heard the audio version, but
because David Lynch does his own sections. Each author does their own sections, and David Lynch's sections are just, because he reads them out in obviously David Lynch's voice, very occasionally loses his temper, like when he's describing school. And he just goes, "It was a waste of my fucking time." It's his quote. He just sounds genuinely angry when he gets down to it.
Oh, superb.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant, brilliant recommendation. Love and Let Die. Yo, no, that is it. Love and Let Die. Yeah, it's been in my head so long as Love and Let Die. I forgot that Live and Let Die is the name of the podcast.
Oh, God, tell me about it. I so have that problem.
You've been living with it, I imagine, for quite some time. is a brilliant read and highly recommended. And also the William Blake book, which is called William Blake versus the World.
The World, yeah. William Blake versus the World.
Anybody who is curious, that's also... You know, it's obviously not on film as such, but is there a poet more cinematic than William Blake, I wonder? Brilliant, John. Thanks so much.
A real pleasure talking to you, John. Thanks for having me.